All right, good evening, everybody. Wonderful to have you all back again. Everybody, of course, is staying warm. It is cold out there. And so we got out of our first little snow in 2 years, and now we're getting ready for our next snow this weekend, from what I hear. But like most tragedies, the Jewish people will survive. We'll get through the snowstorm. Don't worry. Okay. We have a very difficult psalm tonight. I don't know, there's an echo here somewhere. We'll turn it off for a second here. Okay. I'll tell you ahead of time. Let me share my screen. Where? Here it is. Share screen. Okay. This is the psalm for the evening. It's a difficult one. The theme I can work with, and we're going to talk a lot about it. But whereas in the previous classes, we've literally broken it down verse by verse and spent a lot of time on the textual aspect, tonight I think we're going to take more of a global picture. And let's just read first the whole thing. It's only six sentences, eight sentences. It's not that long. Shir HaMaalos, this is again another Song of Ascension. That's the section we're studying. Rabbat Siraruni minura yomer no Yisrael. Oh, since my youth, they have often assailed me, let Israel now declare. Even when we were just a young, budding nation, almost not even a nation yet, they were already oppressing us. And again, verse 2, since my youth, they have often assailed me, but they have never overcome me. Boy, is that true. Even from our earliest days, if you recall, Jewish history really begins as a nation. Well, they start earlier. The Jewish people begin as a people with individuals, with Abraham and Sarah beginning as our first patriarch and matriarch of our nation. Their children, Isaac marries Rebekah. They have Jacob. Jacob has the 12 sons. They form ultimately the 12 tribes, and they ultimately, with the story of Joseph, they end up down in Egypt, right? We're familiar with this story. And down there in Egypt, even though things went well in the beginning, at some point, we became enslaved. We weren't even a nation yet. We were known as the Hebrews or Ivrim. We weren't the Jewish people. The term we use, B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, that really doesn't happen until the end of the story of the Exodus. As we leave, the Jewish people go from individuals to a family unit to ultimately a nation. But that nation is forged through the crucible of Egypt, all of the suffering. So even from our earliest days, and even after we leave Egypt, we're not even out of, and we don't even enjoy our freedom for but a few weeks, and we're immediately attacked by Amalek. The nation attacks us on her way out of Egypt. Again, unprovoked. We didn't start anything. Sounds very familiar, right? And we're immediately attacked. And we go ahead and we're taken to Mount Sinai, and God gives us a Torah. And then we wander because we are not living up to our mission of following God's command. We serve the golden calf. We go ahead and we send spies. We don't want to go into the land of Israel. Fine. 40 years pass. We conquer the land of Israel. Takes them 14 years to conquer and divide it amongst the tribes. And within a short period of time, again, the Philistines, the Amorites, you name it, any of the neighboring nations, they're attacking. Even in our heyday, when King Solomon builds the first temple, it's never, not never, it's relatively unusual for there to be such quiet. That is the story of our history. And this psalm, King David begins by saying, since our earliest days as a nation, they have often tried to harm us. They have distressed me since my youth. But the Jewish people declare that, yes, since they've tried really hard since my youth, but they have never overcome me. They have never conquered me. We have not only survived, but we have thrived. We'll come back to the rest of this in a minute, but I think it's worthy for us to take a step back and really look at this concept. I don't know about you, but certainly, since the in the aftermath of October 7th, there is a lot of feeling of, I'll start with a positive. There is a certain sense of unity amongst the Jewish people. There is a certain sense of camaraderie, of just connecting one with the other, despite our differences in terms of observance or even political ideology. We recognize that Hamas didn't care about it. We shouldn't either. And there is that upsurge, that upstart of goodwill and that good feeling. However, just for myself, and I share this honestly, I have gone through three phases. Obviously, when it first occurred, there was tremendous anger. It was tremendous. My heart hurt from the pain of what had happened in the tragedy. But then, as I said, there was this positive. There was a feeling of we're going to get through this, and we know that we're going to get through it together. And it continued that way. For me, it was November, even into December. But as December went on, and I felt a certain level of, I don't want to use the word despair, but it was heading down that path of where we're sending in our troops. We're conquering, if you want to use the term. We're trying to rid ourselves of Hamas, but we still haven't found hostages. And our brothers, our sisters, our nephews, our nieces, unfortunately, we're suffering tremendous casualties. It pains me every day when I look up the news and I see the ticker of number of soldiers that have been killed. We're coming close to 200 already. 200 soldiers. That's a lot of people for us. There is that feeling of, again, maybe depression and despair is too strong of a word, but I'm a little dejected. I'm a little down about it. I have to remind myself of this psalm. This is the long game. We, as the Jewish people, don't look at things strictly with blinders and look at the events only as they're occurring. That is not our view. That is not how we discuss it. That's not how we look at life. I'm just going to take this off of. So I'm going to. We'll come back to the sharing in a minute. But people like to see the whole picture. This is an important concept. I'm sure we've touched on it in the past, but it bears repetition. There was a fellow. We all know him as Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva, one of the greatest leaders of the Jewish people in the time of the Mishnaic era. Okay. Rabbi Akiva, we know his early beginnings was as somewhat ignorant in terms of Torah and his Judaism. And thank God for his wonderful wife, Rachel, or in my family, we say Rachel, right? It's Rachel. She saw the greatness of Rabbi Akiva and she inspired him and she sent him off to go study Torah. And he started as a 40-year-old man learning Aleph-Bet. So no excuses, folks. I don't care how young you think you, how young you are or otherwise, you can always learn. Okay, he started at 40. We all got thank God, a head start on that. So there's always what to learn. But the great Rabbi Akiva, I read you a story that the Talmud records. Okay, Rabbi Akiva used to say that a person should accustom himself to always say that whatever God does, Gam zu letova, it's for the best. He would say it in Aramaic. He would say, Kol ma da'avid rachmana, whatever God, the merciful one, would do, letavavid. Always for the best. Okay, it's a beautiful mantra. It's a beautiful way to live life. But the Talmud says a story with Rabbi Akiva himself. He was once traveling along on the road. When he reached a certain city, he tried to find lodging. He tried to find a place to stay over, but no one offered him a place. He had nowhere to go. He said, okay, whatever God does is for the best. So he went ahead and he slept out in a forest, in a field. Now, what did he have with him? He had three things. He had a rooster, he had a donkey, and he had a lamp, for light. Okay? He lays down to go to sleep, and a wind comes along and blows out the lamp. An animal came along and devoured the rooster, and a lion came along and ate the donkey. Rabbi Kiva kept saying after each one of those events, it's all for the best. Letav of it, it's all for the best. What happens? Next morning he wakes up. Obviously, he didn't have the greatest night's sleep. And the Talmud says he went back into the city. I guess he had business he wanted to go there for. And he found out as he's getting close to the city, he sees that it's destroyed. An army had come through and captured the city. And he remarked to himself, see, I always say that it's always for the best. Had he found lodging there, who knows what would have happened to him? Had the lamp still been lit, the marauders might have seen him and might have gotten him. If the rooster would have crowed or the donkey would have brayed, it would have given away his location. But while each one of those events were happening, what would you have responded? Would you have smiled and said, it's all for the best? I don't know about you, but I would be very challenged to say things like that. I probably would use language that I probably shouldn't. It probably would, if I have some, I would say, okay, deep down, I know that God has a plan. But it's hard. The great Rabbi Akiva was teaching us this lesson. And the truth is that we can look at this in a very, very important way. Because what Rabbi Akiva is telling us is that when we experience things in life, we become blinded and we become narrow focused to only see that moment and not see a bigger picture. And that is not the correct view. Sure, when the lamp got blown out, my reaction would have been, oh, you've got to be kidding me. Come on. I couldn't find a place to go. I finally managed to get to, I'm gonna like, really, God? Come on, cut me a break. And then, an hour later, I'm counting on the rooster so I can get up in the morning and have a, maybe, I don't know. Really? And each step along the problem, obviously, now is that I wouldn't have taken the long view, seeing a bigger picture. Now, that doesn't mean Rabbi Akiva, he was very fortunate. He got the answer to his long view in one night. He got the answers right away. But a life, a guide through life is to always view things this way. Let's take an example. Let's take another example here. Let's talk about a famous story. The famous story of where Joseph, who had been down in Egypt because he was sold by his brothers, right? He became viceroy, became the second in command under Pharaoh. Long story short, there's a famine. The brothers come down. He gives them food. He accuses them of spies, yada, yada, yada. Finally, he reveals his identity. And finally, he convinces his father, Jacob, to come down to Egypt to settle in a suburb. Probably the first instance in history where it was already predicted the Jews are going to want to live in the suburbs. Fine, a little outskirt of the city called Goshen. It's not in Egypt proper. Okay, fine. The Torah records the fateful meeting between Jacob and Joseph. They have not seen each other in over 2 decades. And the Torah tells us that when they got together, here's what it says. It says, Joseph harnessed his chariot, went up to meet Israel, Jacob, his father in Goshen. He appeared before him. Listen to the words carefully. He appeared before him, fell on his neck, and wept on his neck excessively. They met. He cried on his shoulder, on his neck. Okay, we're not going to focus on the neck part tonight, but please note that it's in the singular. It doesn't say that Joseph harnessed his chariot, went up to meet Israel's father. He appeared before him and they wept. It does not say that. The Torah's terminology is, and he wept on his neck. Who's the he weeping on his whose neck? Fair question. number one. And number two, why isn't the other person crying too? Why is it only one person crying? So Rashi there on the spot tells us that it was Joseph who was crying on Jacob's neck. Jacob himself was not crying. Rashi is bothered. Why not? Says Rashi famously says that he did not fall upon Joseph's neck. He didn't kiss him. He didn't cry because Jacob at that moment decided he wanted to recite the Shema. Okay. Question number three. Really? You can't wait 3 minutes to say the Shema? I get it. For whatever the reason, he wants to say the Shema, but right at that moment, this is what's important to understand. Let's try to put ourselves in Jacob's shoes. Jacob has this family, and he's trying to raise this family, and he has what is clear, a certain favoritism towards Joseph, which he, by making the special colored coat that he gives to Joseph, that conjures up a certain feeling of jealousy amongst the brothers. The brothers hear Joseph giving these grandiose dreams about what seemed to be leadership and taking over, and how all the other stars are going to bow to him and the sheaves are going to bow to him. He's going to be a numero uno. And the brothers don't like that. And the brothers sell him. Okay, we know the whole story here. And what do they come back? And they tell their father that, look, this is his coat. We all recognize it, and it has blood on it. And they don't say the words outright. They weren't going to lie directly, but they let Jacob come to his own conclusion that, oy vey, an animal must have devoured my son. Oy, 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 oy. And in Yiddish, he was a tzebrachen a mensch. He was broken. He was broken, so hurt by what could be. He wonders what's going to be? How is this going to play out? I had this vision, I had this prophecy that I was going to be the father of 12 nations. It's maybe the prophecy's wrong. You can put yourself in Jacob's shoes and you can begin to doubt everything. Maybe I'm not worthy of it. Self-doubt. Maybe I didn't do everything. Maybe I shouldn't have treated Joseph this way, even though I knew he was supposed to be the leader. What's going to be with the brothers? And on and on and on. Not for 3 months, not for 6 years, not even for a decade. We're talking more than 20 years until he finally gets the message that Joseph is alive and he is the leader of the family, and he himself is going to save them from famine and mate and lead the path for the Jewish nation to be able to survive what ultimately would to be the Egyptian servitude. Joseph, I'm sorry, Jacob, at that moment where he sees Joseph, he is overcome not just with an incredible feeling of gratitude to Hashem, because if that were the case, Shema wouldn't have been what he said. He probably would have said Moda'ani. He would have said thank you to Hashem. He would have said some prayer of thanks. Shema is not a prayer of thanks. It's a declaration about God as the one and only. What's this got to do with this fateful meeting? So if you read the words of Shema, that first sentence, you have Shema Yisrael, listen, Jewish people, right? In that case, listen, Yisrael. Hashem Elokeinu. Hashem, God, is our God. Hashem Echad, God is one. We've talked about this, how the different names for Hashem represent our perception of God in different modalities. The name Hashem, which is spelled in we call the Tetragrammaton, the Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey, right? The name that we don't actually pronounce that way, that represents God's attribute of mercy. Elokim, Elokeinu, our God, the way it's spelled that way, is associated with God's justice, strict justice, when he comes down and he rules and says, here's what the law is, here's what has to be, the concept of reward and punishment. That's the modality we perceive as Elokeinu. Yaakov says, I have constantly struggled. Sometimes I see you, Hashem, as Yudke Vavke, merciful, kind, compassionate. And sometimes I see Elokim, judgment, strict justice. Are there two conflicting worlds? Are there two conflicting gods, heaven forbid? And sometimes God A wins and sometimes God B wins? Says Yaakov, no, I recognize now Hashem Echad. It's always Yudke Vavke. It's always with mercy. It's always compassionate, even when there's strict justice. Why is he saying this now? Because he understood that these 22 years where he did go through a lot of suffering was part of a much greater, bigger picture, a much longer view on what's going to be for my family. Had he had his magic eight ball and he would have asked, does this end up good in the end? The magic eight ball would have said, absolutely. It would have said, hang on. There's a long view here. There'll be bumps in the road, but keep your eye on the big picture. Hashem, what seemed to be versus Elokeinu, in truth, it's Hashem Echad. It's always Yudke Vavke. The ability to not judge incidents individually, but taking a much longer view. Everything is Gamzu Latova. This too, I don't understand why sometimes, but even this is Latov, is for the good. If we had a magic eight ball that allowed us to see more than a day at a time, more than a month at a time, even more than a year at a time, or a 10-year, we would see that there's a much greater picture here. But it's hard. As human beings, it's hard to live that because we live in the here and now. What the Torah here is teaching us is that we have to train ourselves. Jewish history is not a year long. It's not even a century long. It's millennia long. It's the only way to view it. And that's why our psalm begins by saying, King David says, even from our youth, they tried. And guess what? Here we are, 3,300 years later, we're still here. We're still doing our thing. We're still practicing our religion. Yeah. Got to take the long view here. Don't get caught up in those individual moments. That is the mistake or what Jacob was grappling with. The Chofetz Chaim gives a beautiful parable of a fellow who's never been to synagogue before. And he comes to shul for the very first time. He finds a seat, fine. And he watches as the gabbai gives out the honors, gives out the aliyos. So he notices that the guy who got called up for the first aliyah was actually from the right side of the synagogue, about three rows from the front, halfway through the bench, halfway through the row. And then the second person who got it was actually on the left side, towards the back, maybe a row or two from the end, all the way on the aisle seat. And then the third guy was over on the right side, but he was also halfway through. And then the fourth guy's in the front, and the fifth guy is about... He goes over to the gabbai, and he says, that is the most inefficient system I've ever seen. What's the matter with you? Why don't you start row one, seat one, give him the first one, and then go to row one, seat two, and give that person it, the next one, and go in an orderly manner. What is your issue? That is such a silly system. The gabbai looks at him and says, my dear friend, really? You show up for the first time and you have questions about the system. Do you realize how ridiculous that sounds? But I'll humor you. I'll explain it to you. You see, had you been here last week, you would have seen that the guy in row one, seat one, actually had Yahrzeit, and he got an aliyah. I'm not going to give him 2 weeks in a row. But the guy in row one, seat two, he actually is making a bar mitzvah in 3 weeks, and that's when he's going to get an aliyah. And the guy in row one, seat three, has whatever, and he can explain why each person. But you show up for the first time and you have questions? How short view, you know, like it's such a short vision you have. You have to take a bigger view of it. The Chofetz Chaim used that as an analogy, as a parable. We come into this earth, we're already 5,000 plus years late on the story. This story started 57, 84 years ago. And now we come on the scene, and of course, we think we know it all, and we got questions. God, how could this be? Wow, you mean to tell me that the righteous are going to suffer like this? I don't understand you. How can you make such a cla Relax. And even if you want to say you figured it all out the first 57, 84 years, how long are you going to be on the scene, Tachman? What, at best, 120 years? 120 years in the scope of history is diddly. It's garnished. It's a nothing. It's a blip on the radar. We got questions. Yeah, they're good questions, but understand you're walking into a system that is looking at a much greater view. We have tunnel vision. This is part of the lesson that needs to be said over and over. And that's what Rabbi Akiva's statement was. Everything God does is for good. I may not see it right here, right now, but in the ultimate picture, when you take the entire scope of work from the beginning of the creation of the Jewish people till it's God willing, its ultimate end, you will see how it all makes sense and was for the best. Don't ask me, Zvi Tachman, how to answer every single incident why that is for the best. I can't answer that question. I don't know. But if you ask me point blank, do I believe that it is always for the best, even when it's so hard? The answer is unequivocally yes. This is an important concept. My father of blessed memory told me something that he heard from one of his teachers. Let's focus for a moment on the Shemoneh Esrei, the Amidah. Right? We're all familiar with it. The very first blessing. Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu, Elokei Avoteinu, Elokei Avraham, Elokei... See, I even have to chuckle when I say it. Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Now come phrases. Okay? Blessed are you, Hashem, our God, God of our ancestors, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob. Hakel, the great... Hagadol, the mighty. I'm sorry. I skipped the line. The great. Well, Ha'el is the awesome. Hagadol, the great. Hagibor, the powerful or mighty. V'hanorah, and the awesome God. Now come two expressions. El Elyon, which we translate sometimes as the supreme ruler, the supreme God. Gomel Chasadim Tovim. Who bestows loving kindness, who bestows beneficial kindnesses, v'koneh hakol, and creates everything. Typically, most sidurim put commas between each one of those expressions. So, for example, if we were just for emphasis, we would say, Elokei Avraham, comma, Elokei Yitzchak, comma, Elokei Yaakov, comma, Hakel, the Almighty, Hagadol, comma, Hagibor, the powerful, comma, Vahanorah, and the awesome, comma, Kel Elyon, supreme God, comma, Gomel Chasadim Tovim, who bestows beneficial kindnesses, comma, and comma, 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 each one. Okay? My father's teacher told him one of those commas we have to take out. The comma between Kel Elyon, supreme God, and Gomel Chasadim Tovim, who bestows kindnesses. There should be no comma between them. Why? Because when we, using our theme for tonight, is that only the Supreme God, who sees the entire picture, knows that what he just gave to us is in fact beneficial kindness, even if I can't see it. Even a patch on my hand, a timeout that a parent puts a child in, that's also for their benefit. Kael Elyon, only because he's the supreme God who sees everything and sees the full picture, he's the one that can testify and say, Gomel Chasadim Tovim. He is the bestower of kindnesses every step of the way. I don't see it that way sometimes because I see strict justice sometimes. I see tragedy. I see disasters. And I question it because I'm not Kael Elyon. I'm not the supreme God who sees the whole picture. That's what my father's Rebbe told him. Therefore, let's go back to this question in terms of Yaakov. Yaakov went ahead and I said, right? He was now struggling. When he saw Yosef, it was so crystal clear to him that this 22-year period was all for a benefit. Why did it have to go the way it did? I can't answer that question. Only God can. But can Yaakov say without any hesitation when he sees Yosef and the position he has and how that was the blueprint for the saving of his family? Yaakov can say it without a doubt, yes. And that's why he said Shema at that very moment. It's a beautiful insight from Reb Chaim Shmulevitz. He says this idea. But the truth is, there's more to this. There's more. The story really is, goes back to our early history. Goes back as follows. Let's talk about Yaakov and Esav for a moment. We're all familiar. Yaakov and Esav are brothers. They're twins, right? Not exactly identical twins, and neither physically nor ideologically. They are on two very different trajectories in life. And we're told the famous story of where Esav sold his birthright for a little bit of lentil soup, right? We're all familiar with that story, okay? Let's fast forward, and then we'll come back to that again. Fast forward, Jacob gets the blessings from Isaac, which totally ticks off Esav. And Esav swears he's going to kill him. Jacob has to flee, and he goes away, and he goes to Uncle Lavan's house, Uncle Laban, okay? Another fine, sterling character in this, in our Bible, in the book of Genesis. Another role model for us to look up to, okay? Uncle Laban, I'm joking. Uncle Laban is a trickster every step of the way. I just want to make sure in case nobody takes me literally here. Okay. The good stuff I'm teaching you, take literally. The jokes, just let it slide. Okay. So what happens? He's there, fine. He plays the whole game. He's there for a long period of time. And now Jacob's on his way back home and he's going to have this meeting with Esau. He doesn't know whether Esau is still fuming. He sends messengers and he sends a tribute and he prays and he divides the camp into two. Okay. He finally meets Esau and he gives a message. The message he forwards with his messengers is that I have been living im lavan garti. I have been dwelling these past many years. The reason for my lateness in coming back to see you is because I've lived under Lavan's roof for all these years. I've been living with Lavan and I waited until now. Rashi says, what does that mean? You're telling him that you lived by Lavan? What do I care? Like, what is that? Why would that be the introduction to meeting Esau? So Rashi tells us that what Yaakov was doing was saying, the word in Hebrew is im lavan garti. Garti means I dwelled, but it comes from the word ger, which means I'm still a sojourner. I'm still a foreigner. I never took up residence. In Hebrew, there's two words, a ger and a toshav. A toshav from the word yoshev, which means to sit, to dwell. Ger is somebody who's there temporarily, but he's on his way somewhere else. He's still a foreigner, even if he's living there, but it's not his home. It's not where he feels he's setting up shop. So he turns to Esav And he says, Im Lavan Garti, these last many years, I was just living under Lavan's roof, but I'm still a nobody. I'm still just a foreigner. I'm still going from place to place. And all those blessings that you got upset that I took from our father, nothing ever really came of it. I'm not leading a whole civilization. I'm not a prince in any area. Nobody's bowing and giving me homage. I'm still just a, I'm just Jake, just a guy. There's really nothing here. There's no justification for you to be angry with me anymore. And even with the cattle and the donkeys and all this stuff that I have, it's not as the blessing had promised. Isaac gave over the blessing that said that all of the blessing will be from heaven. You'll get the dew. And like you're talking about majors. I have a little bit. I have a cattle, I have cattle and I have donkeys, but I'm not living off the fat of the earth. All that those promises had been meant. Don't worry, Esau. The blessings never became fulfilled. Now, on the surface, you can just say, okay, interesting, but you really have to wonder. This explanation that Rashi quotes from the early sources is really very bothersome. Jacob knows darn well that that's not just a passing blessing. He knows that it's a prophecy, that Isaac had given this as a prophecy. Is he turning to his brother and saying, it really wasn't a prophecy? Our father lied. It really never became fulfilled. That's hard to believe that Jacob would utter such a thing. And not only that, Jacob's not a fool. He knows that blessings like this don't happen overnight. He doesn't live in 2024 where the whole world thinks everything has to be instantaneous. It has to be gratification. If your internet goes out for more than 10 seconds, we're going cuckoo. We're going nuts. Oh my God, I gotta call Comcast. This is crazy. I can't have it like this. Slow down, relax. We survived. Don't worry. But that's not, Jacob understands that blessings aren't, they're never fulfilled immediately. It doesn't diminish their value or their significance because it takes time to fulfill. So what is it that he's telling Esau, don't worry about it, nothing ever came of it? The answer is let's go back to what to what Esau actually said when he sold his firstborn rights. What's the story? Jacob is there cooking the dinner. He's cooking supper. Why? Because everybody has just come back or on their way back from burying Abraham. So they're mourning. So lentil soup, fine. Lentil soup. And in walks Esau, and he's starving. He had a rough day hunting. So he says to his brother, pour into me some of that red, red stuff. Doesn't even identify it. It's just red, red stuff. He doesn't even know it's lentil soup. He just sees something red cooking on the stove. Doesn't even identify. It's just red stuff. Very superficial. Jacob says to him, I'll give you some of that. Michra kayom. Sell it to your birthright, your firstborn right to me, kayom, like today. Meaning to say that just like today is real, I want you to sell me as if, it's a real deal. Not something made up, not something just pulling out of thin air that we can renege on somebody at a later point. Sell to me like the day your birthright. What kind of crazy expression is that? Just say, sell me the birthright. What's kayom like today? I mean, do you guys talk like that? I don't. Can you imagine I walk into Seven Mile Market and I say, I'm looking for some red peppers. Will you sell them to me like today? Huh? Now, what kind of, they're going to say, okay, you need to go visit somebody and it's not available at 7 Mile. Like, do bismashiga? Are you crazy? Who talks like this? Sell it to me like today. So our sages point out Yaakov was talking to Esav on his terms, in language he understands. Esav only sees today. It's all about what pleasure can I get today? What are the ramifications for later? I'm not worrying about that. Why is Esav willing to give up the birthright? Why? He says outright, he says, because ultimately I know that the firstborns are the ones who are going to end up serving God. And you know what? That's not for me. That's not my gig. I'm going to get myself in trouble. I'll be the first Jew thrown out of yeshiva. I'll be that guy. Esav says, it's not going to happen. So you know what? I'm not interested because that's a future. What can I get for it? Tell me, Jake. What if I sell you the birthright, what do I get? Oh, you'll sell me some of the soup? I'm in. Soup, that's gonna warm me and it's gonna fill my belly. When? Today. Esav's mentality is all live today, because tomorrow you may die. Get as much pleasure in as you can now, because who knows what tomorrow brings. That's an Esav mentality. Right? He knew. They don't have, Esav doesn't have the long view. Yaakov, no. Yaakov says, I see a bigger picture here. Yaakov, our patriarch, says, I'm on board with a long view. I see the long game here. He's got a vision that says, you know what? If you take the view that this firstborn right will eventually entail serving God, not now. Jacob never becomes that servant of God. That doesn't happen until the temple, which is more than 500 years later. Yeah. But Jacob has his eye on the bigger picture here. That's the way we have to look at it. This is a general approach in life, as we've said all night. When we're faced with the dilemma of choosing the pleasure of the moment or choosing a long-term view at the cost of deferring some instant gratification, if you don't have a mentality of looking towards the future, of looking at a bigger picture, you're gonna sell yourself short every single time. Yaakov was willing to wait. He knew, right, that if he comes to Esav after 34 years and he says, look, nothing came of it, Esav's gonna be like, you're right. You're still a nothing. You're still a nobody. See, in Yaakov's head, 34 years ain't nothing. 34 years is a drop in the bucket. I have my eyes on 3,400 years of history. That's what I'm buying into. I got the long-term investment. You all know this. If you really want to play the stock market, you got to be in it for the long term. That's where the gains will be. The short term, man, that is just stress city. Up, down, up. Every day you're pulling your hair out. You got to have the long view. That is the Jewish perspective, time and time again. With this, if you'll allow me, yeah, I got time. We understand another idea. The Torah tells us that we're not allowed to mix certain things. There's a lot of anti-mixing laws in the Torah. For example, the classic is we don't mix milk and meat. We don't eat them together, right? We don't mix wool and linen. We don't wear. We don't plant different species of fruit. We don't graft fruit trees. The Torah has a whole concept of anti-mixing laws. One of those laws is very interesting. It says that when you want to put a yoke on your animals so that they help you plow the field or whatever it is on the threshing floor to break down the kernels, you know, the chaff and get all that. The Torah says you're not allowed to put under the same yoke an ox and a donkey. Two separate, you cannot put together under the same yoke the ox and the donkey. The simple reason is because they work at different speeds and they also eat differently. How they eat, right? And to one is going to cause pain for the other. It's like, you know, Laurel and Hardy trying to get something done. I mean, it's like one wants to go the other way. That's what made it so funny, right? It's not funny from the Torah's perspective. You're causing harm to the animals. You can't put a donkey and an ox together. That's the simple understanding, and we can move on. However, I read something this week. Beautiful. Beautiful. There's a deep symbolism about specifically the ox and the donkey. Let's talk about the ox. Why does a farmer use an ox? What does he use it for? Typically, you harness the plow, right, to start, and it's going to pull the plow so that it makes furrows. And then you're going to go ahead and you're going to tie seed, bags of seeds or whatever it is, and you're going to have them go through all this. The ox is doing a lot of the work, not for the here and now, but for the future. Because ultimately, all of those seeds and all of the furrows and all of the watering, all this is not going to produce anything for a while. The ox doesn't see, so to say, the results until who knows, months later. What's the main usage for a donkey? The donkey is a schlepper. The donkey is to help you carry something from point A to point B. When? Right now. I have something that needs to go to the market. So I'm not going to put it on my ox. I put it on my donkey. My donkey is a strong animal. It can carry a tremendous amount of weight, but its main function, you're not going to use the donkey necessarily to pull the plow. That's not how the farmers use them. The donkey's existence is all about the here and now. The ox is all about how you play it out for the future. Says the Torah, don't harness them together. They're two different philosophies in life. Not only because of the pain each one causes the other, but from a philosophical standpoint, they're diametrically opposed to each other. Not only that, similarly, the way they eat. An ox is a ruminant. It chews its cud. A donkey does not. The concept that an ox is one of those that, so to say, it doesn't really regurgitate, right? But it goes through the various stomachs to process it means it's been there and I'm going to come back to it and I'm going to go, but it's not just eat and done. Eat, get into the stomach and poop it out. I mean, that's a donkey's perspective. Just eat, get your nutrients and get rid of it. The ox is chews its cud. It's more and again and future. And what else can I? It's not an instant gratification. The mentality of what an ox symbolizes is about the future, the long view. It will help you make the furrows. It'll help you plant. It'll help you even harvest at the end, but that's months later. Donkey is all about here and now, schlepping something from point A to point B. The point of being part of the Jewish people, it's not the point. It is the defining point. It's the defining essence of what it means to be Jewish is we are in it for the long game. We do not live our lives for the here and now. We live in here and now with an eye towards the future. Always living it this way. That is really, I think, one of the most astounding lessons that we need to learn. And I'll read you because the hour is late already. This answered my question about, my feeling of as December moved into January, and we're still not where I thought we would be in this war. I really thought we would have accomplished much more than we have. I feel a certain lack of optimism. This restored me again. And I'm going to read you from an article I found that I love it. I loved it. I loved it. I love it. He writes, many of us struggle to remain optimistic about the future state of Israel and the future state of our people. Dread runs high while confidence runs low. Envisioning the long view of Jewish history restores faith and reinforces optimism. We face many uncertainties in the immediate present, but the larger narrative of Jewish future has already been written. We know exactly how this all ends. We just don't know how quickly it ends and how circuitous the route toward the terminus. Faith in Jewish history affords us the confidence to navigate the adversities of Jewish history. I'll skip a couple of paragraphs. Many refer to this war as the Second War of Independence. This terminology assumes that the consequences of 1948 can be neatly wrapped into the first 75 years of our state and that we are currently embarking upon a new chapter. I, he says, prefer to call this war a continuation of the War of Independence. It may take us several generations to fully achieve the independence, sovereignty, and security we so desperately seek. It will certainly take multiple generations to achieve the religious, spiritual, and moral condition we've dreamed of. Taking the long view of Jewish history mustn't distract us from present and immediate challenges. but it should provide optimism even during dark moments. Slam dunk, in my opinion. I definitely couldn't have said it better than that. But that I truly believe is what we need to focus on. This is the ideal that is being brought out in this psalm. And if you have the opportunity and you want to read the rest of it, it talks about this. I mean, I'll just look at it quickly and then I'll end with a couple of quotes. Really, some really excellent quotes. Okay. Since my youth, they have often assailed me. Let Israel now declare. Since my youth, they have often assailed me, but they have never overcome me. Plowmen plowed across my back. They made long furrows. This is referring to the fact that the torture that they have inflicted upon us as a people, it's not just that they plowed my back. They made long furrows, not just a short little jab. They dug deep and they dug for a long time. The Lord, the righteous one, he snapped the cords of the wicked. The first thing God does is he takes us out of pain and he cuts the cord that's holding us. Let all who hate Zion fall back in disgrace, and let them be like grass on roofs that fades before it can even be pulled up. They will become nothing. They will become temporary pains in the neck that affords no handful for the reaper, no armful for the gatherer of sheaves. Doesn't even amount to anything in the end. And no exchange with passers-by to say, oh, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. We bless you by the name. None of that will take place for the wicked that have tried to enslave us, that have tried to harm us, that have consistently persecuted us. There is not a good end for them. If you go, I don't, now's not the time, but this is really what's being said here. But let me finish with two or three beautiful quotes. Number one, we'll start with Napoleon. Napoleon, not exactly our Jewish hero, but Napoleon said the following. I have to read it to you. It's so good. Oh man, where'd I put it? Left it up there. I don't remember the exact quote, but he said he was wondering. He came across when he came into Israel, when he tried to conquer. So he found the Jews on Tisha B'Av. The Jewish people were sitting on the floor crying about the loss of the temple. And he was absolutely astonished. And he asked about it, like, why is everybody sitting on the floor? And they explained to him that we're mourning the loss of the temple. He said, well, when did that happen? Oh, he said, oh, 1,000 years ago. What? You're crying over 1,000, 15 or whatever the number was, crying over that? He was astonished and he said, a people that can still feel the pain of what happened 1,000 years ago for what was lost, what they consider their temple, will have a future of a reward to ultimately see it again. Because it means you have a vision of a long picture. Napoleon recognized that. Franz Kafka, right? Sharp, but a certain tortured sense of Jewish identity himself. He once commented and said, we Jews are born old. How true that is. We're born as old people because our history is in our DNA. We're not the new kid on the block that just shows up and thinks knows it all. But perhaps my last quote. I was surprised to find it, but I loved it. Let's see if here it is. I'm going to share it with you right now. Hold on. Look at this. Look at this quote. Oh, come on. Why? Where'd you go?
Get your money.
Here it is. I think, can you see it? I think the most important thing is to take the long view on things. We live in such a 24/7 Twitter-fed constant news cycle, and everything's a crisis. Everything is terrible. Everything is doomsday. Everything is, if it doesn't get solved tomorrow, your presidency is going off the rails. Who's that from? Barack Obama. He's not wrong. Everything, like we go crazy sometimes. Oh my God, what is the whole thing? Take a step back. There's a big picture here. We can do this. Let's breathe. It's a challenge. We'll get over this, but don't get caught too much in the moment. This is the essence of being part of the Jewish people. We are in the long game, long view, long vision. That's what we always have to keep in mind. And I got tremendous inspiration when I read this and I put it together and I saw that idea of how to apply it to the current situation in Israel with the war. Don't give up on the big picture. It's hard. Some days the news is terrible, but this is not an isolated incident. This is part of a long, long, long chain of Jewish history that we'll see in its ultimate end, the correct answers, the right over right being victorious over wrong, and this will be the good ending. Just, you gotta have the long view. That's my message for tonight. So not as in-depth on the text, but I think a really, really important idea. Any questions? Any thoughts? Great. Oh, Sharon, thought I can get off.
That you're going to get away with it. So my thought is that yes, it's good to look at the big picture and look towards the future, but isn't it also good to not just lay around and say, and not do anything because
100%. This is not to the exclusion of that. You
right.
have to live in
Okay.
the present.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You can't sit on your duffy and just say, well, it'll all work out and then do nothing about it.
Right.
Of course
So you
not.
have to keep moving forward and doing things all
100%.
the time. Keep striving.
100%. Rabbi Akiva went ahead and he took his lamp and he took his rooster. Why didn't he just go without anything? Why didn't he just say, oh, God will provide? That's not how it works. We do everything we can. But when it doesn't, and when the curveball comes and it didn't play out exactly as we thought it would, do we throw up our hands and say, oh man, I'm stuck. This we'll never get through this. Wrong. That's the wrong answer. That's really the focus I wanted to make tonight. Of course, you have to do the live in the here and now to do everything you can for this. But keep your eye on the bigger picture.
You gave me that quote a long time ago, and I still have it.
Which?
Gamzu
Gamzu Latova. Yeah.
Zok.
Gamzu Latova. Nachum Ish Gamzu. Rabbi Akiva's teacher was this fellow named Nachum. And he got the nickname Nachum Gamzu. That was his name, Nachum Ish Gamzu. Nachum, the man who always said, this too is for the good. Rabbi Akiva was his student. And Rabbi Akiva said, that's the approach. Everything God does is Latav. It's all for the best. That's where he got it. Gamzu Latova. Practice it. Gamzu Latova. This too is for the best. Always. All right. Great job, everybody. I'll see. Yeah, Robin, you had a question?
It's not really a question, I guess it's a comment really quickly.
Okay.
So looking present, looking future, and then I think part of it is and like with the story with Joseph and other people, it's being somewhere in the future looking back to the past. Whereas you don't know what it is now, but or even Jacob, but when you look if you're there somewhere, 20 years down the road, you can look into the past and realize that all these things sort of happen for a reason for the best.
Correct. Absolutely. You're right. Past, present, future. It's one long thread. We don't live just in the present. And like Sharon pointed out, I don't live just for the future. But like you're suggesting, I also have to keep in mind that there was a past that we're connected with as well. 100%. Susan.
Also a comment. I love this, and I thank you for sharing about the oxen and the donkey. I just love that story. It's just
Fascinating.
brilliant. It's just brilliant. What I wanted to say is that this the long view versus the short view mentality, it's also a beautiful lesson from the Musar world in terms of our practice of of humility. Like, who are we to think, that we have all the answers in this moment, It's a wonderful orientation to so many parts of it, of faith and having faith and recognizing that we are We are, you know,
Just one
human.
piece. We're one piece in a much
One
larger
piece,
picture. We are
yes.
one puzzle piece, but an important one. The puzzle will not be complete without each one of us.
Right.
But we are not the puzzle in its entirety.
Right. And that speaks to what Sharon had raised up, that yes, totally up to us to do our part. Yeah.
Good. I'm glad it resonated with you guys.
Thank you.
Perfect. All right. So then, God willing, I will see you guys next week. Have a great rest of the week. Good
I was interested
Chavez
in.
and stay warm.
Yes, stay warm.